You're listening to the Thank God for Nostra podcast.
All right, welcome to another episode of the Thank God for Nostra podcast. I am John, also known as Hoddlebod. I'm the developer of the Coracle and Flotilla Nostra clients. And with me today, back again in the studio, his studio, not mine, unfortunately, is Jordan Bush. Jordan, tell us about yourself.
Sure. Yeah, I am the executive director of TGFB Media, one of the authors of Thank God for Bitcoin, and the recent author of The Gospel According to Bitcoin, out now. Go get it on Amazon and please leave us a review. That'd be great.
All right. Nice. So today we've got another kind of catch-up thing. We've got a couple of articles that we want to talk through. We've got a nip to draw your attention to.
Let's go.
Harsh nips, our favorite segment.
By popular demand.
But to get started, I wanted to read a verse, as is our sporadic tradition. Psalm 119, verse 37 has something that is relevant to what we're going to be talking about today, which is, "Turn my eyes from looking at worthless things and give me life in your ways." So as we get into the topic, that'll make more sense. But since we got two articles, Jordan, I'm going to let you choose which one would you like to get started with?
Yeah, I mean, I say we let's go to a little bit more of the doomer one first, and then we can kind of talk about the other one that's more of like a response of kind of a what to do about this. So, John,
metalogical.
Yeah, you found this article by Ted Gioia, I think is his name. I don't know how to pronounce it. Gioia?
I'm not even going to attempt it. Yeah, so I found this actually via the Theology Pugcast with C.R. Wiley and
nice.
And those guys, which is one of my favorite podcasts. If you haven't listened to it and you like what we have to say, that's great, because everything that I have to say is hand-me-down from them. they did a whole podcast on this article, and I figured why not do the same?
Yep.
Beat that dead horse. But yeah, it's super good. It's basically a state of the culture, kind of drawing off of the themes of the presidential turnover here, the state of the union. And it was really good. It has a couple of concepts in it that I think we have actually covered now since we read the Web of Our Own Making book. I read this back in December, but it was impactful enough, made me think enough that I wanted to put it in my back pocket and bring it back. So, what was your takeaway from the article, Jordan?
Yeah, I mean, my takeaway was, I feel it, I see it, I recognize all these problems. We've kind of talked about a lot of it, and then again, the underwriting thing that sticks out continually is the incentives to do. The incentives that drive this type of thing. It's short-term incentives to make money, to be able to survive, honestly, is it's the putting of survival above health. The survival of companies and corporations above the health of people. That seems to be the overriding theme of everything he brings up.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, and so his thesis is basically like, he looks around the culture and what is the activity that you think of when you think of culture primarily? Well, it's art, right? Art mm-hmm. is what the culture values, what it's thinking about, how it communicates, what's important to one another, a locus of values, all that kind of stuff. And he's pointing to the frustration of a lot of artists feeling like their art is getting harder and harder to publicize and draw attention to. And it's being eaten by entertainment. the entertainment industry is just growing and growing and growing. But he also notes some problems in the entertainment industry where the number of U.S. scripted original series per year is actually declining. People are spending more money to purchase rights to artists for rights to music that's by dead artists rather than living artists. So the new art that's coming out is not as valuable as stuff like what he points out in Michael Jackson's song catalog. And, the Beatles obviously is a famous one. He says musicians are actually worth more old than young, dead than alive. And so he's like, well, what's next? And he says, well, actually, we're already seeing entertainment, which is eating the, he has this diagram of fish, right? Art is the yep. little fish. Entertainment is eating art. Entertainment industry is taking away from the art industry. But there's something behind it that's even bigger, which is distraction. I just want to bring this one up because it was a really helpful paradigm shift for me to say, like, to be able to distinguish between entertainment and distraction. entertainment is something where, you're dealing with a story, you're grappling with, something that's logical and potentially linear, what's his name?
McLuhan?
McLuhan, as McLuhan would point out. And then distraction is nonlinear, simultaneous, and chunked up into smaller and smaller segments. The Web of Our Own Making book kind of points that out, that distraction is a aversion to committing to doing something for a long mm-hmm. period of time or to putting any kind of effort in. Entertainment, as much lower of a thing as it is compared to art, does actually require a certain amount of commitment and focus. It requires something of you, but distraction is turning away from that. But like a lot of our entertainment, a lot of the things we spend our time doing are actually more distraction than entertainment. They're not things that demand a lot from us. And then the logical conclusion of distraction is an even bigger fish that he puts behind distraction, which is addiction. This is something that I think people are a little bit more familiar with, more comfortable with, because people actually feel addiction a lot more. Distraction is often kind of like invisible. But addiction eats distraction because, you know, distraction means that you're actually directing your attention to something. Addiction, a lot of the time you can open your phone up and try to be distracted, but actually fail because you just open an app that you just opened because you weren't even paying attention to what you were doing, stuff like that. So anyway, that's kind of the framework he has for the evolution of the culture. We're in addiction world now. We've left distraction behind, and entertainment and art are way, way in the rearview mirror. And often function only as fuel for the distraction economy.
Yeah, and I think what you see when you look at this is you have where is this addiction coming from? It's coming from specific platforms who are trying to build customer loyalty. They're trying to get people on their site, and attention is one of the prime ways to do that. And so what you have, you have individual companies prioritizing their own survival over the survival of the people who are their customers. And so again, anytime like this is at odds with how God created people and entities to exist. Like they're designed to foster the flourishing of people and communities and not to prey upon them and consume them for their own, for their own benefit. So this is like the edible mother, like, you know, consuming, it's like, you know, chewing up. Actually, we just had this conversation in a clubhouse conversation the other day of, you know, like, again, parents were made to lay down their lives for their children. Like they were made to die. Like you lay down your rights, you lay down your agenda when you have a kid. You know, this person is completely dependent on you. Human children aren't like animals where, you know, within a few hours of being alive, they can kind of, you know, many of them can kind of exist on their own independent of their parents. But in the case of babies, you're fully human babies. You're fully reliant on your parents for a period of years. And so to see these tech corporations faced with, because of fiat currency, monetary devaluation and a lot of other things, faced with this challenge of, if we don't get people on our platforms, we're going to die. They look at that option and they say, well, we have to survive. Our survival as a company is the most important thing. And so we're willing to sacrifice anything on the altar of our own survival. It's a disgusting way to live. and it's honestly terrifying and going to produce very bad fruit, which again, we're seeing in real time, I think that Gioia, or however you pronounce the name, Gioia, does a great job of outlining it. This little fish illustration that we have pulled up here is fantastic. I think you do, again, this idea of freedom comes through not like through a lack of requiring something of you. You know, like we there's a truth obviously to that. There's a truth that like there's a healthy search for ease and a healthy search for convenience that again nobody would deny. But when it gets to such a radical extreme like this, again, this it's gone way too far in the other direction. And again, is not serving anybody's interest except for a very small group of people who are working at these platforms.
Yeah, and that's a problem that I still don't know how to solve. I've been, you know, as I've been thinking through all this stuff, I've been getting a good idea of what that problem actually looks like. But it's hard to, you know, it's tempting to want to solve the problem of too much of that kind of freedom with more freedom. Like there's the kind of truism that more speech fixes the problems with free speech.
Yep.
And in our second article, we've got a little bit of a different perspective on that. It talks a little bit more about policy. We'll get there in a second. And then also, spoiler alert, we're going to be reading Nicholas Carr's new book, Superbloom, in which he takes, I think, more of a policy-oriented approach. Likewise, recently I've been looking through the work of Center for Humane Technology, who's behind the Social Dilemma film from 2020. And they great criticism, and they're really, really smart people. But their solutions are always policy solutions. And that just makes me so, so nervous. But also grappling with the history that like Nicholas Carr presents in the beginning of his book about radio, it's like, okay, well, can it be any other way? Is there a place for policy? So I think it's something that it's worth thinking about. But that's a little bit of a tangent. And going back to
I do think this is the interesting thing, and it's going to be uncomfortable, and I think healthily uncomfortable to return to the subject that we just were talking about. I think it's healthily it's a good level of discomfort that maybe that libertarian leaning people like us, or libertarian sympathetic people like us, you know, who are skeptical of the government doing anything. I honestly think this is a healthy corrective. Like, we need to be challenged to think about the government's role and stuff like this. Because honestly, again, the thing that we're not helped by is that, again, as we mentioned a number of times, we're in a definitional crisis in as a country, as a society, as a world. We don't know what anything is because we've rejected any kind of objective truth source. We've completely rejected the idea of God. And so what we get is, you know, just governments who are gods. You can't really get rid of God. You really just get somebody else playing that role. And so I think it's actually, you know, from a biblical standpoint, from a Christian standpoint, like, we believe that there is a role for government. You know, it's to punish evildoers and to protect those who do well, according to the book of Romans. And so I think that, you know, implicit in punishing evildoers is defining evil. And so I think something like these, like the things that we're looking at, are actually evil. Like, they're actually going to result in, you know, the destruction of society and the destruction of families and people and, you know, all of the above. And so I think that there is a place for policy in this fight. Again, there's going to be all kinds of disagreement over where do we draw lines, but I think the thing that everyone should agree with is that, you know, even a quote-unquote arbitrary line would be better than, you know, complete unbounded existence at this point. Like, we just need to get a hold on this to some degree, and if it has to be, it's not actually going to be totally arbitrary, but we just need some kind of line, because this idea that freedom comes from unbounded access to whatever we want, like, that is just being demonstrated to be having horrible consequences on especially the youngest people, youngest members of society.
Yeah, and I think a really interesting dimension of that how much policy sort of question is, what vantage point are we standing at? We're standing at the end of 100, 150 years of more and more and more policy,
yeah,
fiat on top of fiat, case, yeah, law. And so, like, we, despite having all that constriction of policy, yeah, our problems are not any better. And so it leads, obviously, to a natural skepticism of policy. But also, you kind of have to understand the starting point of that slide, which is the freest nation that's ever been, where, you know, we didn't have income tax at the beginning. We were so free at the beginning of this country. So, like, you know, we started from an extremely free point. We've slid towards, you know, more governmental oversight, but we're still like pretty dang far along on that liberal end of the spectrum. So orienting ourselves and finding balance is, you know, we have to understand who we are as a people, but then also where we are historically. So yeah, it's very challenging. And my hope, of course, as an Oster developer is that we can basically exercise responsibility, individual and collective responsibility, to say, like, you know, don't rush to making policy to impose stuff on an unwilling people.
Yeah.
Instead, let's teach the people how awesome it is to have an internet that actually works in the interests of users. Because, like, this addiction and distraction stuff, this is not revealed preference. It's not user choice. We've been herded into this like sheep. And that's partly because of the dynamics of the internet. And a lot of people talk about the internet and its decentralizing qualities as, you know, inviting this huge wave of centralization in order to fill a vacuum. I think there's a lot of truth to that, but also, like, the internet was not configured. We did not have the tools that we have now, in terms of cryptography, digital signatures and stuff like that, to solve the problem. Not to go back to Carr, but like, in his chapter on the history of radio, I'm spoiling it all for our future podcast. It's a good thing I haven't read the whole book yet. In the 50s and 60s, they were like, we don't have the tools to prevent people from misusing radio. And so we just have to make extremely stringent laws about who's allowed to broadcast on what frequencies. And now, like, the internet in a way is kind of a sandbox. We don't have access to the physical laws of reality in this as directly as you have with radio, which has its good and bad points. But the harm you can do through a liberal, like, very open and free policy on the internet is way smaller than the harm you can do with radio.
Yeah.
Because you can actually, like, get in the physical way of other people. Anyway, I digress.
I do think, again, for whether or not you love or hate Trump, like, one of the, I mean, just the whole idea of Doge existing, like, Department of Government Efficiency, regardless of how retarded it is that name was really chosen because of a garbage currency, cryptocurrency.
Wonderful.
Like, I've talked about this on other podcasts where, like, my criticism of government, and I feel like what a lot of people who reflexively would say, I'm an anarchist and I don't think there's any role for government, blah, 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 what they're really reacting against is a government that is far more akin to a morbidly obese man. And so, like, we look at this morbidly obese man and we're like, he's worthless. Like, get rid of him completely. And the reality is there's a very useful man far somewhere in that giant obese man. Like, he could actually be doing limited amount of good things that he's designed to do. But instead of contenting himself with that, he's taken on 100 other things that he shouldn't be doing. And so I think, the solution for government and the solution for a lot of these things, it's, you know, it's limiting, it's drawing lines, it's putting him on a diet, it's putting governments on a diet. And so I think that a diet for, you know, social media intake or, you know, whatever it is, I think these are the type of things that are needed. The question is figuring out how do you implement something like that. And I do think a huge part of it needs to be training people to love the limitations, rather than, you know, in training people to think and think about what it means to be human and you know, see these things themselves, see health as something that they do play a role in. But I think also at the same time, we need to realize that there's systemic, you know, structural things that, you know, that governments have a responsibility, a God-given responsibility in terms of their responsibility to care for their people and punish those who are knowingly acting against the interests of their citizens. And everyone, as this article lays out, Zuckerberg knows, all these guys know, you know, they know what they're doing, and yet they're still choosing to prioritize the existence and monetary profits of their own companies over and against the good of their users.
And the excesses that we currently have may be the best way to teach people that, to have that value shift if we can. So, you know, there's not a lack of hope there for sure. But yeah, to to return to the article, he has this great illustration. It's a chart. And yeah, look it up. It's thehonestbroker.com, state of the culture.
We'll put the link in the show notes. And then again, I've been sharing the screen. So people, if you're watching this on YouTube, or on our website, which I recently, ooh, that's something we can talk about too. If you're watching it there, you can see, you can go ahead and see the, this chart. It's actually up right now.
Yeah. So it's this matrix of, slow traditional culture, fast modern culture, and dopamine culture. And I just thought this was really illustrative. You know, yeah. I think normally when I think about this evolution, I think about the evolution of video. So you've got film and TV, which is slow traditional culture, where people, you know, go to the cinema to watch things or gather around the TV together in the house. And then fast modern culture is video. So it's more of an individualistic thing, but it's still potentially long form. And then dopamine culture is reels of short videos. But it applies to all these different other media as well. Journalism goes from newspapers to multimedia to clickbait. Music goes from albums to tracks to TikToks. I think a really interesting one was the athletics one. So slow traditional culture, you know, you go out and you play a sport. If you're not the one playing a sport, there's no one playing a sport. So there's no one to watch. But this has turned into watching a sport, fast modern culture, either in person or on TV. And then dopamine culture is gambling on a sport. Who needs to watch it when you can quantify it and see if you can make some money off of it or lose some money? You know, that's almost as fun. Another one that's good is like relationships goes from courtship and marriage to sexual freedom. But, you know, that's not the end point. That's what a lot of people think of as the end point of is just, you know, sleeping around and promiscuity. But it's not. Like, the end point is actually dehumanization and you end up swiping on an app in dopamine culture. It's actually too much trouble to go out and be sexually promiscuous. So, you know, that is a super, super bad sign if the culture is too lazy to get out and do all the sinning that they want to do. It's like,
this is honestly, I was reading an article, I can't remember what it was, it was probably a year ago, and they're basically saying that people under the age of 30 are having less sex than like any culture in the last like 100 years or something. Maybe ever, honestly. And it's because of this, right? Like, again, this has relationships, but you could do like a sexual matrix where it'd be like physical sex, in the fast modern culture, having, you know, physical sex with, you know, a number of people, and then the dopamine culture could just be watching porn or it could be, you know, like participating in OnlyFans, you know, either starting your own OnlyFans or, you know, signing up for somebody else's. Like, rather than participate in the sex, you're watching the sex happen. You're becoming a passive participant, in this sexual relationship rather than actually involving yourself.
Yeah. And I would say, like, it goes even further, right? You know, passive participation, that's the fast modern culture version, but we've pushed past that into absence. We were talking about this, last episode, but, swiping on an app, you're not doing anything. You're not there. You're not even passively interacting with anything real. You're just passing the time. You're trying to distance yourself from anything that's worth doing. Same thing with scrolling on a phone, TikToks, reels of short videos, clickbait, gambling on a sport. You're actually stepping away from the thing. You're not even looking at it anymore. You're looking somewhere else. You're really looking inside. It's a very solipsistic sort of activity.
Yeah.
And this, Goya explains, leads to anhedonia, which is the complete absence of enjoyment in an experience supposedly pursued for pleasure, which is a really interesting concept where, you know, he compares it to opioids. Opioid dependence actually makes the pain worse because it stops having its effect. And so what we do for fun now is we distance ourselves from the real world, from anything meaningful, and then we suffer.
Yeah.
For fun. Yeah. That's what we spend all our time doing. It's pretty dark. So,
the whole thing of like these things that we want to make things easier for you. We want to, you know, increase ease, and yet that turns into greater pain. Like, that's the irony of, you know, the irony of this cycle.
Yeah. And there's a little bit more to the essay, but I that's what I really wanted to draw attention to is like, as we, as technologists try to rebuild, social media in a way that doesn't, that contributes to human flourishing rather than continuing to push people down this road. Because like, that's something that Nostr could do. If we're not exercising our agency in how we're using these technologies, now we're just more free to do all of this dopamine culture kind of activity without intermediaries. Like, yay, freedom. I get to destroy myself without watching ads. Awesome. But I hope that a reorientation around the user is will partly lead to a reorientation back around real life. Because, yeah, we're embodied creatures and anhedonia is a real thing. We're not enjoying being trapped in the dopamine culture loop. So
definitely. All right, so moving on to our other article. So again, this that was kind of like the that article was very helpful, very, you know, descriptive. This is what's going on. This is how it's hurting us. But there wasn't a whole lot of, you know, again, not that you need optimism or not that you need, not that there always has to be like an action step type thing. You know, it's what he wrote is great. Like, it's, I'm not trying to criticize him, but it does lead you to the question of like, well, is this just a whole hopeless thing? Do we just, you know, what do we even do about something like this? And so I was encouraged to find a group of people over at First Things. If you're not familiar with First Things and you're a Christian, like, I don't know what you're doing with your life. You need to go go support them. If you can afford to, you know, sign up for their physical, you know, journals, go ahead and do that. If not, subscribe online and access some of the most thoughtful, poignant, just brilliant writing from a largely Christian perspective that's out there. And so a bunch of people who I've had the privilege to meet in the last year or so are, you know, helped to contribute to this. So it's this article called A Future for the Family, A New Technology Agenda for the Right. And so this is, it's basically kind of like a manifesto of, you know, given all these things, X, you know, A, B, C, D, E, F, G, you know, and technology, the way that it's affecting, given what's going on in the world, you know, here's what we want to stand together to, you know, to follow these and to pursue these 10 guiding principles to empower families through technology. That's kind of the purpose of this article. So, I don't know, John, we'll start there. What were your thoughts before we get into the specifics of what they propose?
Yeah. So, first, I apologize for the conversation whiplash, but I do want to, I wanted to mention OLOS, right? So if you're familiar with OLOS, it's a new app by Pablo, a Pablo of the many apps fame on Nostr. And it's basically an Instagram, ripoff. And you know, at first glance, it seems to do exactly what I'm saying we shouldn't do, which is reinforce all of this, you know, sort of hedonism, dopamine hedonism in the digital world. And I asked him about it. I was like, Pablo, why of all things did you spend your time making an Instagram clone? And he reminded me of Instagram before Facebook purchased it. You know, the icon that Instagram's app used to have was like a wood grain icon. Yeah. And, you know, the app worked differently. You could only post one thing a day and that was it. Or one thing at a time, I think, maybe. So there was ephemerality to it. There was focus. There was, it was designed to encourage people to be mindful and present of the things that were actually in their lives. So what Pablo is trying to encourage people to do is actually to look around them in the real life, find something that's worth taking a picture, take a picture and then put it on OLOS and with the hashtag OLOS365. So you're using the internet every day, but you're using the internet every day as a way of refocusing yourself on the beauty of the natural world and of your family and of the things that are around you, which is a great mission. I really like that. So these digital technologies are not necessarily detractive of the real world. It's that Instagram was captured and turned to Facebook's purposes for increasing engagement. So I just want to mention that. But yeah, on the First Things article, I was really pleasantly I don't know, like not surprised necessarily, but it was well, the 10 points that they mentioned are really well put. And it goes back to what we were talking about before about policy. You know, a lot of these are policy things. And I was reading through the list and I was on number 4 maybe and just saying like, oh, they're all policy solutions. But they actually got to some technical solutions at the end of it. So I think it's pretty balanced. You sent me an article, another article recently by one of the guys who drafted this, Brad Littlejohn, who used to go to my church. And he has moved more and more into the policy and legal side of things. And he was, the article is basically talking about a victory they had about protecting children on the internet.
Yeah.
By requiring websites to verify users' ages before they let them in. And I read that and I was just like, oh, that seems so dangerous. Like the cost of KYC is so much higher than the benefit of protecting children. And it's not like I'm against protecting children, but
yeah.
It would be so much better if parents could do that.
Yep.
But the fact is parents aren't doing that. And so now the government is getting involved by saying what software developers are allowed to do or are obligated to do. Yeah. And I hate it so much, but I don't know what the alternative is except like, you know, cultural, reformation and, revival.
Yeah.
But, that question is at focus in these points. And I think these points, may strike a pretty good balance, a little heavy on the policy side again for me, but
yeah. And again, I think some of that has to do with the authors, right? Like all of these people are working most of these people are working in a policy capacity. Like they're working in Washington, D.C. They're working with think tanks or with universities or with, you know, like that's very much, again, a system is what it does, you know? And so like the fact that you're going to find more policy solutions, it's not going to be surprising. Again, I think what you just articulated is a great example of, you know, you need people in these rooms. You need people who are able to help think through some of the costs to something that seems as obviously good as, you know, age verification for some websites. Like there's many ways in which you think of how many kids we'll be able to protect, you know, all these kind of things. That sounds great. They're not thinking about the trade-offs or maybe they're not, you know, maybe they're not as aware of the trade-offs. And so again, trying to strike a balance with those things is difficult. I would love to go ahead.
Can you blame them too? Like, they're talking about policy because policy is, it's a way easier thing to approach than technological solutions. Cause like, you know, these people are mostly on the right, generally. And, technological solutions to social problems have been pursued mostly by leftists over the entire history of the internet. It's like there is very little technology, pro-technology DNA on the right wing. And so coming at it from the right wing, like, of course, policy. And then, of course, these policies are largely things that would appeal in a bipartisan way. So it's like, there's an opportunity and we could actually get something done rather than, you know, these sort of castles in the sky that the technologists are working on. So,
and just the other thing working against this type of thing is the fact that doing something always looks better than not doing something. So like,
that's true.
You know, just the idea of like leaving freedom out there, leaving potentiality is less sexy and is more difficult to gain funding than saying, hey, we have this great list of things that you can do. Things that you can pursue, restrictions that you can put on. Again, that kind of thing just draws attention because there's businesses that can help you do that kind of thing. There's businesses that can benefit from these things. And so I think this is one of the things that I just see over and over again is if you, no matter what your business is or your nonprofit is, if you are focused on survival rather than acting in the best interest of your customers, which in a fiat dominated world is increasingly the case. Like everyone's just struggling to survive. You're going to be more and more faced with difficult decisions that again, and so basically what this is, to me, is a cry for people. They need to invest in what they want to see. Like, you need to invest in the world you want to see, whether it's in the form of, you know, for-profit entities like Thank God for Bitcoin, or nonprofit entities like other, you know, there's a number of other, you know, in the Bitcoin and technology space. What's the nonprofit that funds a bunch of Nostr stuff? It's
OpenSats.
Yeah. OpenSats, yeah, stuff like that. Like, you have to support the things that you want to see. If you're not going to support them, then who in the heck is going to support them? And so I just think this is, it just becomes more clear to me as I am somebody who's running a for-profit business, and, you know, somebody comes from a nonprofit background, you know, this, it's, you know, there's, you should build businesses, you should work to come up with ideas that can generate their own income. And then also at the same time, you do need to be generous and subsidize, you know, organizations and efforts that, you know, are focused on something more than monetary profit. They're denominating profit in human welfare beyond simply making money.
Yeah, and I can't wait until we can read a Wendell Berry, because I think it's a whole different domain, but he does a fantastic job of articulating that, you know, human flourishing motive over profit. So,
yeah.
Well, why don't we read through these points and just talk about it as we go?
Yeah, so I'll read it for us.
Okay.
These human goods are fundamental for thriving families and must be guarded and advanced amid revolutionary technological change. To these ends, we offer the following 10 guiding principles for empowering families through technology. Number one, respect the natural cycle of mortality by healing or mitigating chronic disease rather than pursuing radical life extension, and palliate the suffering of terminal illness rather than artificially accelerating death.
Fantastic.
Do you want to just stop one at a time? I say we just do that rather than just read.
Let's talk about it.
What do you like about this one, Don?
Well, I have been accused of being pro-death. Like, I have had an atheist who I have respect for say that Christians are a death cult. And, you know, I've mentioned this before. And it's like, okay, no, like, we believe in life after death, like you pointed out last time I brought this up. But also, like, extending your life is not necessarily pro-life. There's a way in which there is a right time to die, and extending past that is you're actually denying life by, you know, potentially taking up resources that other people need in order to live. You're preventing people from escaping from, you know, the role of a parent in a child's life. Like, it's actually, that's a rite of passage. If your parents never die until you're ancient as well, you're just tampering with all these like natural cycles and balances that exist in reality. And those things, not mere living, are what constitute life. So, you know, juxtaposing life extension to healing or mitigating chronic disease is a very cool way to think about that, as well as palliating the suffering of terminal illness rather than artificially accelerating death. So, you know, the pro-life or the life extension kind of guys, they're also generally pro-abortion and euthanasia. It's about the, you know, the individual gets to choose when they die or potentially choose whatever's convenient. And it's like, you're trading off all these things in order to have more living, but you're actually destroying the content of life. It's very much like this dopamine culture thing. It's like, it's the same sort of thing. You are never exercising any skill to learn anything difficult or invest yourself in anything. You're only spending time doing what's most convenient for yourself and living this solipsistic life. So I think the two are really, you know, akin.
Another thing that people just don't think about is what the incentives to do stuff like this. So the incentives to, you know, pursue radical life extension of, you know, just the number of years that you're alive rather than taking into account the quality of those years is one of the effects is that frequently the majority of, like, if you're somebody who's worked and have savings that you would, you know, under normal circumstances, historically, you know, you would die and then you would give that to your kids. That would provide a launching board for the rest of their, it'd be a huge helpful thing for them and for future generations. A lot of that money and those resources are eaten up in the last couple years of life to help try to extend, you know, these lives. And so what happens is you have this radical wealth redistribution from away from individuals and families to these healthcare corporations. it is, I mean, it was infuriating. I just remember coming to the realization of like, that's really what's going on. Like these organizations are trying to figure out, how do we make money? And they figure out this is a giant cash cow at the end of most people's lives. We can frame this as we're extending their life while taking away this, you know, billions and billions of dollars. It's horrifying. It's horrifying. And then again, what that does, you know, generationally, the effect that it has, it's just less money that is in the hands of individuals and families. And it just, to a greater and greater degree, weakens the family even more than they are already been weakened by other policies that we're going to talk about on this list.
Yeah. And like, it's hard to defend our position sometimes because we're basically saying, yes, people should die.
Yeah.
And yeah, I mean, we agree, like, death is the enemy of mankind.
Yeah.
But because of our faith and then also understanding of what the character of life is, you know, I heard something a long time ago about creation, right? God created for 6 days and then he said it was good. And that's another way of saying that's enough. God said, I'm going to limit myself. I'm going to say, yep, I'm done. Yep. Maybe arbitrarily, maybe for some deeper reason. But as people bearing the image of God, we have to say enough as well. Like, I've lived long enough and this is good and it's time for the next thing. And, you know, you were talking earlier about the government being this giant, bloated, overweight,
morbidly obese. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It just reminded me of, Envy in Full Metal Alchemist.
Oh no. I don't know what that is.
Dude, it's a great anime. It's a little dark. Okay. It's very dark, but, I'm not normally an anime person, but it's very good. But Envy is this embodiment of, one of the seven deadly sins. And he just like ingests people. And then he's got like people's arms sticking out of him and becomes this huge, huge monster. Anyway, you know, that's what happens. That's Envy. Like, the government has not said enough. The government has not known where to stop extending its power and its influence. And similarly, like, we should not be like that. We should know when to stop extending our influence, and our, you know, including our life.
Yeah.
And also, you know, not to terminate it too soon too. That's the flip side of the coin.
Well, I think, and again, we've talked about this a lot, but I think, so then the question could be for somebody, again, if you're somebody who's listening to this and, you know, you're not coming from, you know, if you're listening to this and you're like, okay, Christians, you guys sound weird. Like, what in the world? Like, I think it comes down to who is drawing the lines, you know, like the nature, and the, you know, the non-arbitrary nature of the laws that are being drawn, you can find them in the Lord's Prayer. Jesus' disciples, they come to him and they ask him, you know, they say, Lord, teach us to pray. And Jesus begins teaching him. He says, you know, this is how you pray. Father, who art in heaven, may your name be considered holy. May your kingdom come and your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. And so this is what it means to be human. Jesus isn't just trying to articulate, you know, for his limited small follower group, some arbitrary foisting upon them, you know, something that is contrary to what it means to be human. Jesus is defining what it actually means to be human. And what it means to be human is to live not for your own benefit, but for the glory of God and the good of those around you. And so this, you know, this morbidly introspective, you know, thinking about only yourself, whether it's, you know, extending your life because you're terrified of dying, or trying to end your life early because you can't imagine, you know, a purpose for your life, or, you know, you're suffering. Again, I've dealt with depression. I've dealt with, you know, suicidal ideation when I was younger in my life. And so this is not trying to minimize any of those things. Again, but at the same time, like, there's a healthy, like, basically to be human is to, you know, is to come to grips with the reality that we are not gods. We're going to die someday. And we are not the ones who choose, who put, you know, a timer on that clock of death. God has appointed unto man, you know, a certain number of years. And, part of being human is humbly, submitting ourselves to that reality rather than trying to assume an authority that does not belong to us.
Yeah. Cosine. And if anyone wants to think more about this, I encourage you to go read Psalm 90. One of the verses in there is, teach me to number my days that I may gain a heart of wisdom.
Mm.
So right along with everything we've been saying.
Yeah.
All right. Number two, support women in their natural ability to conceive, gestate, birth, and nurture children rather than seek to bypass or short circuit the female body or reduce it to organs for rent. I think this is really just an extension of the first one, but obviously a little bit more finger on the pulse of a lot of you know, issues that we are currently working with in the political world. So I don't have much else to say about that one, but
yeah, again, it's the same broad thinking is, you know, what, like, these are not, our bodies aren't our own to do with whatever we want. Like this kind of radical individualism, radical individualistic understanding of freedom is anti-human and unhealthy. Number three.
And,
oh, go ahead.
And taking things out of context, you know, the sort of short circuit the female body or reduce it to organs for rent, taking a baby from a woman's womb who's carried it for 9 months and handing it to a gay couple. There are going to be unintended consequences, you know, moral world and natural revelation aside, like that is going to cause so many problems that we don't even know how to anticipate. So,
and we don't even need to hypothetically anticipate them. We can find many stories of gay couples who have adopted, you know, children and then were found to, you know, sexually abuse them. So again, yeah, horrifying. The other thing too, is the effect that this has to where functionally, functionally the ability to conceive children is looked at as a burden. Like it's looked at as this is a negative thing. And so what that really is saying is that male existence is the ideal. And so basically it leads to women, you know, wanting and wishing they could become men. It's this radical envy that you talked about. And to, you know, there's a famous G.K. Chesterton poem that talks about about men and women. If you type in Chesterton men and women, go find it. It's a fantastic poem. All right, number three, protect human sexuality from ongoing commodification and dehumanization by violent pornography, digital prostitution, child sexual abuse material, deep fakes, AI sexual companions, and sex robots.
Yeah, I obviously agree with this one. I thought it was interesting how they don't actually call out just regular pornography.
Yeah. Right?
They're actually like, they're only focusing on the really, really bad stuff, not just, and not really talking that much about the really bad stuff, which I thought was strange. If they're taking such a strong stance on the first two, you might as well just say like all kinds of sexual sin, we should try to disincentivize, you know, not necessarily make it illegal. That is a whole other question, but disincentivize, like these are not good things. They're not good for human flourishing, including softcore porn and like swimsuit magazines and stuff like that. Like it's just not good. But I do think an interesting, this is one of the points that is most risky about technological solutions to these things, is if you give people agency, they're able to pursue their own desires. Sometimes these desires are good. God gave us many good desires, and we have been manipulated away from those good desires into terrible habits in the digital world. But there are still lots of people who have natural desires, you know, in an unsanctified sense, that and freedom technology is going to give these people the ability to traffic in, you know, child pornography, sex slavery, like all that stuff that is very alive, happens all the time. Now, of course, you can say, like, you know, with the same argument people make about Bitcoin, Bitcoin allows people to launder money more easily. And it's like, well, okay, even if it did, like, the evil is still there, and you should pursue the evil, not the method. I think the same thing about freedom technology. But at the same time, as people making freedom technology, if we're trying to encourage people to make good use of it, it's okay to report child pornographers to the authorities. Like, that is not against the mandate of freedom technology. So, you're losing my camera. Sorry about that. My Pixel 4 has a terrible battery life. just one thing I've been thinking about on this topic is like, what if you had a bot that just scraped the Nostr network? Because like pretty much everything is public, right? Yeah. And just reported stuff to the authorities. That would make it so that you don't have to rely on image hosts to do that, because now that we have Blossom, everyone can self-host their images, which is a great thing to have content addressable images that are self-hosted. Fantastic. However, now we have this problem. So, you know, I think that would do a lot for solving the public side of things. But yeah,
and in a national though, also announcing that you're doing that is going to discourage a lot of it as well.
Yeah. Which
we've seen with something as simple as the, you know, illegal immigration, you know, like a lot of that kind of stuff. Like the Trump administration announces that they have the political will to prevent this from happening. And lo and behold, like it stops happening. So I think even just there's some of this that is going to be helped just by the expressing the intent to do something about it.
Yeah. Yeah. Just messaging that Nostra is not a safe place for criminals to go and do a bunch of awful things that's an okay thing to do. So number four, work to wrest childhood from the grip of social media and smartphones and encourage free play and personal interaction in their place. Hold companies accountable for designing platforms to undermine human well-being and exploit the most vulnerable phases of childhood development, and remove screens from the center of the classroom while restoring physical books and the mechanical arts.
Yeah, what were your thoughts on this one, John?
Oh, again, just I like this one a lot. I have a problem with public schools. You know, like we homeschool, and looking at public schools, I just think it's complete insanity on so many levels. Like, okay, yeah, it's great that it's free, and it's great that there's teachers who can like focus on teaching kids certain stuff. I get why it's so attractive, but the decisions they make and the disconnectedness that parents have from public schools a lot of the time is just crazy. And putting devices into the classroom, that was something that I have always been just floored that that was a thing. And probably like the door was opened by computers, because computers are easier to justify. But giving kids tablets in public schools, public school classrooms, you got to be so like brain dead to even suggest such a thing. So I'm very, very pro this point, but at the same time, I'm pretty indifferent to the whole state of public schools because my kids don't go there. But like tons of kids go there. And if we want a healthy society, like, to the extent the government is already involved, yes, they should do a better job. And I'm all for removing funding from public schools, but that's a complicated operation at this point.
So that's an episode for another day. Very easy case to be made, but again, we'll make that at a different time. I think this gets at what we were talking about earlier, where we mentioned Zuckerberg, where in the other article, Gioia talks about the fact that Zuckerberg was alerted the ways in which this platform was being abused, the ways in which the consequences on especially younger people, and he flips him the bird and basically it just says, we're not going to change anything because it's going to affect their bottom line, at least in the short term. And that's his primary concern. Not good. Go ahead.
The idea of giving kids devices to I've done some of that with my kids, like obviously very supervised, watching videos with them and playing games with them. And I think there's an extent to which that's all right. But it is like, it's amazingly influential to kids.
Yeah.
It really does melt their brain. Just watching a movie or something like that. And I'm starting to come to terms with what about the internet is unhealthy for boys. Because like, it's pretty obvious how girls suffer with digital technology, like self-image stuff is so big. Boys, it's a little bit more complicated, I think. But I think games are in a large part what is so dangerous about the digital world in contrast to social media. Games encourage boys to sort of back off from doing anything either social or difficult. And there's obviously like tons of exceptions to that, but I'm just realizing after having gotten my kids into computer games to play together because I enjoy them, like maybe that's not the best idea, and I'm thinking about walking those things back.
That's again no pushback from me here. Again, a lot of the if you look at the temptations, masculine temptation from the beginning, like the very first temptation in the Garden of Eden is Adam passively sitting back and doing nothing while his while his wife is tempted. And so I think that, you know, we just recognizing that temptation and, you know, being aware of things that, you know, tend to, you know, indulge that type of passivity. Again, like we, in our house, like we have, like, there's only a couple days a week when our kids can watch stuff. And even then, like there's times where, you know, we're doing meetings or whatever, we're in the middle of moving right now. And so like all this kind of stuff, they've, you know, in the last couple of months, they've watched more, on those days, they've watched more than they have in the past. And we recognize, you know, a clear difference in how they behave, especially the younger ones, you know, just the way that they respond, and then, you know, cut off access accordingly, because it really does just fry their brains. Let's move on towards number five. I guess we're on. Okay, so oppose the political economy of addiction embedded in the software and user interfaces of smart devices, which capitalizes upon compulsive use, surveillance, and disembodied relationships. Encourage the growing market of smart devices that offer tools for productivity and connectivity only, while ensuring that smartphones are not required to fully participate in our economy or society, but remain a true consumer choice.
Yeah, that is. I think.
Go ahead.
Common sense. It's good stuff. But
yeah,
you know, notice the assumption that this is going to be done through policy, right? Oppose.
Yeah.
You can oppose things through things other than policy and law, but that's kind of the background here.
Yeah. And I think, if you told me that the government signed an executive order tomorrow saying that we do not need any smart appliances in the kitchen, amen. Where do I sign? Who do I vote for? Like, I don't want a smart oven. I don't want a smart refrigerator. I want dumb everything. I just saw a video yesterday, or 2 days ago maybe, of it was a refrigerator from like the 50s or 60s. And they basically, you know, they had like a little quotation above it. Oh, we have to get rid of these because the newer ones are much more efficient. And they took this thing outside in the middle of summer, plugged it in, opened the freezer door. And throughout the course of, I believe it was a month, this thing used like $3.45 worth of electricity. And like, you can see the ice in the freezer, like maintains ice throughout the whole time. It was insane. And so again, I've seen this in a number of different ways as well with other things. Like the quality of products that used to exist is staggering. And so we are not better served by these, you know, by these quote unquote more energy efficient. And then we're also not served by the fact that we're opening ourselves up to create surveillance devices. And especially when a large percentage of these things, almost all of these things, are coming from China, being produced in China, who is renowned for building, you know, software backdoors into all kinds of things, opening up blackmail possibilities, all these kind of things. This is not good. We don't want to live in this world.
Yep, absolutely. And one thing I want to note too about that is, like, so they're talking in policy terms, oppose, but then they're also saying encourage the growing market of things that don't, that are for productivity and connectivity only. So, like, is it necessary to implement policy solutions to increase the momentum of something that's already moving in the right direction, right?
Mm.
Like, I don't know. Maybe we should be careful about that.
Anyhow,
number six, legislate toward a restored Republican culture in a digital age by giving citizens ownership over their own data. Protect privacy by blocking the transformation of everyday appliances into surveillance systems, and require platforms to build robust tools to give users transparency and choices about the algorithms that construct their feeds. All right, so again, policy-oriented. Let's just take the current landscape of centralized Web2 tech and embed good values into it. But like, you don't need that if you have something like Nostr and if people are attracted to it. We're building the robust tools that give users transparency and choices. Russ Ulbricht was released from prison, pardoned, full pardon recently. And I discovered for the first time as a result his articles that he's been writing from prison. Mm. And he's been talking about this stuff for a long time. I read one from 2021 where he talks about, you know, something very similar to Nostr, where you reorient the internet, platform service providers, data providers, and advertisers are back around the user. Mm. So we've been thinking about this for a while, and we're finally pulling the trigger via Nostr. And that's just really exciting that, like, if we can get more people to invest in this technology and see that it solves a lot of these problems without having to apply policy solutions. Because, like, okay, so here's my problem with policy solutions. You ever heard of, like, the strategic cheese reserve?
Yeah.
I don't think it's called that. But, like, there's a giant cave in Illinois that's full of cheese because the government underwrites cheese manufacturers and just guarantees their cheese, and they buy it on their behalf. Same thing with the raisin subsidy. And there was, like, it was a bad year for raisins and grapes in California in, like, the 30s. And we still have this subsidy that makes everything super complicated and dysfunctional in the raisin industry. Like, we just don't need that anymore. But no one has removed these subsidies because the only people who care about them are lobbyists who want to, you know, keep them in place for their own benefit. So, like, putting more fingers in the more pies is just something we should avoid if at all possible. And if we see technology moving in the right direction, then, like, maybe we should sit back and watch, encourage it by, you know, donating or participation. But
again, or like, there's different ways that you can legislate this. So, like, give tax breaks or something like that to those type of, like, if you're building those type of things, give them tax breaks or something where, like, this is not something that it's not something that actually costs, you know, them anything. Like, it benefits them without the government needing to spend more money on it, if that makes sense. Again, I think, again, this is kind of the, like, the idea of rewarding the, like, again, this idea of, you know, the government's role from the Book of Romans, like, you punish those who do ill and you reward those who do, who, yeah, wait, what am I saying? Punish those who do ill and reward those who do well, basically, is what the Apostle Paul talks about in the Book of Romans. And so I think this is one of those things where you can reward them. Like, if you're creating, in the same way that marriage is rewarded and treated differently by tax laws because there's a fundamental obvious recognition of its benefit to society, something like this, like offering tax benefits to, you know, again, things that are pro freedom or actually pro human, again, I think conceptually those are the ways that we should, you know, try to incentivize pursuit of the good. I think that makes a lot of sense.
That's taking fingers out of pies where they already are.
Correct.
So correct. It's the right direction.
Yep. Number
seven. Go for it.
Well, he mentioned, let's see, did we see this was, where did he talk about algorithms? Was that in number
six? That was number six, yeah.
Number six, okay, yeah, there it is, yeah. Choices about algorithms, I immediately thought of Nostr. I was like, hooray, praise the Lord. You know, we've got good stuff. Okay, number seven. Favor technologies that enhance local and familial autonomy through the right to repair laws. Open source software and open platform designs, all of which make technology less reliant on distant power centers. Oppose the imposition of universal technological changes, such as the EV mandate, that undercut the capacity and responsibility of local actors. Amen, amen, amen.
Yeah, I think that's all great. I mean, this is where I finally got excited reading this list, is the right to repair, open source software, open platform designs. That is great. And favor that in whatever way we can, not necessarily by, again, top-down legislation, but you know, there are laws involved with right to repair stuff. So, like, that was a place that was necessary. It's not like we didn't have the power to fix stuff. It was that it voided, you know, license agreements and stuff like that.
Yep. Yeah. Again, I think, again, moving power back towards individuals, back towards families, I think, you know, this is all great stuff that we need. Again, even if I'm not necessarily talking about the policy level, this is something we just need people thinking this way and recovering this grounded, you know, real world embracing understanding of, you know, how the world works and how it ought to work.
Yeah, but policy wonks are going to policy wonk. So as long as they're going to be doing that, fighting for these values is great. Again, and these values also have
respect to Brad, respect to, you know, Michael Toscano, John Asconis, and Emma Waters. Shout to Emma's a friend. So shout to them. But yeah, we gotta have beyond political solutions too.
Yeah, and these points do have small government built into them, you know.
Yeah.
Oppose the imposition of universal technological changes. Like,
yeah,
that's a small government value. So,
yep.
All right, number eight, favor technologies that enhance human skill and improve worker satisfaction over those that degrade or replace human labor, thereby increasing productivity and growing working class wages. Balance the pace of automation by investing in job recovery and skill development to buttress a family wage in the most affected industries, especially those that foster higher marriage rates.
Yeah, this is really good. I'm doing a whole other episode on this article like for Thank God for Bitcoin. I'm going to be doing an episode for the TGFB podcast because of just how central, every single one of these things, you can't think about them and talk about how to do them without talking about money. So I'll avoid going too much into that. But yeah, I think this is interesting. I think this is going to be very challenging to those of us who are more libertarian or at least recovering libertarians. You know, just thinking about freedom, thinking about, quote unquote, the market. We have a very, very limited, very, very limited understanding of what the, you know, and powerful understanding of what the role of markets is, that I largely agree with. But again, I think a lot of this comes down to an understanding of what humans are and like how to pursue human flourishing. And so I think that these things that treat people as problem solvers rather than problem creators, and teach technology as a human enhancer rather than a human, replacer, is going to be helpful. At the same time, you know, part of the reason why the United States is in the situation that it's in, and the West more broadly is in the situations it's in, is because of the economic incentives of outsourcing your labor. And so trying to solve that without doing something about money that just gets more worthless over time and that drives and incentivizes the behavior that we're seeing is going to be fruitless, in my opinion.
Yeah, this is an interesting one. It's like, it's definitely above my pay grade. But, you know, it's kind of an answer to the Luddite, the original Luddites of, you know, there's this shift away from investing in communities and creating economic activity that created, you know, interpersonal community, family wealth, in favor of production and growth. And growth does create wealth over time, but growth can also be pernicious. There can be too much growth. There can be growth that happens too quickly. So, like, managing these inflection points of like AI and automation taking over everything through teaching people how to work in the new economy, like that's a pretty good middle ground. It's not about like stifling growth to protect existing jobs. It's about bringing everyone along with the way that the world is changing. So,
yeah.
Cool. So number nine, accelerate the transition to a new household economy. Clear away policy restrictions on home production and shape labor laws and tax policy to adopt flexible work models that strengthen families and reinvigorate communities while also taking measures to protect the home from managerial overreach and the disruption of family life.
Hmm.
Now, I think this one's really interesting too, because, yeah, I mean, all in favor of it. But it's also reading between the lines, like we're talking about child labor laws.
Yeah. Yeah.
And again, like, I wish that all the parents out there were responsible enough to homeschool and to involve their kids in their work, in a way that isn't exploitative, but it's just unfortunately not the case. I don't really like know what to do with that. But I'm glad they're looking at this.
Yeah. I think it's battling against what has happened. Like, there's a severe overreach. Obviously, like, you know, we're all famous, or we're all familiar with Upton Sinclair's, what's the book? The Jungle, you know, where you have kids working in these factories and, you know, like, they're getting sucked into machines and, you know, they're hiring them for certain machines because they're small enough to actually get in there and do some of this labor. Like, obviously that was obviously happening in some degree. But then to try to just get rid of all child labor as a result of that is the definition of government overreach, the definition of, throwing out the baby with the bathwater. I think there's a lot of good that can be done here. Again, there still is plenty that exists today. Like one of the things is like you can, there's tax incentives towards paying your kids to work for you if you're in a capacity where, you know, where they can do that. My mother-in-law actually hired my wife and her sister when they were in I believe in high school. And she's able to pay them, you know, well for what they were doing. And it was, you know, advantageous to her tax wise. So again, I think there's some of this is just becoming more aware of the tools that are there because I feel like most of us are just so disconnected from these things. But then, yeah, another part is just, you know, winding back some of these labor laws that are just, you know, way overboard.
Yeah, that's super cool. I didn't realize that there's actually subsidies for hiring your kids on the things, because that's definitely a goal of mine. My kids are still pretty young, but as they get into teenage years, I think that'd be really exciting to start businesses with them, have them take over those businesses and have like real ownership and something productive, a productive enterprise by the time they graduate high school. It'd be super cool.
Yeah, love it. Let's see, number 10. This is the last one here. So launch projects that encourage man's cultivation of the natural world and elevate the human spirit. Oh boy. How are we defining this? I'm seeing space travel put forward here. Maybe not.
Definitely.
We've already talked about how I feel about space travel. Such as a renewed manned space flight program and the tech-enabled rewilding of parts of the American West. Dismantled government incentives that push the American people toward artificial or virtual substitutes to embodied life, such as subsidies for lab-grown meat and a viability regime that punishes embodied industries and activities. This is, I would love to know if this is Brad kind of pushing this, but yeah, I've made my feelings clear about manned space flight. I think this is again, satanic CR episode of Thank God for Bitcoin, where we talk about just the usage of resources in pursuing the pursuing space travel when there's a ton that needs to be done here on Earth. Again, obviously there's gonna be things that we find out through going to space that are that are somehow useful to people on Earth. I don't debate that, but I still think that this pursuit is fundamentally unchristian. So I'm not a big fan of it. And then I'm not really familiar with this tech-enabled rewilding of parts of the American West. John, do you have any idea what that's talking about?
No, I'm very curious about that. It's like, you know, the usual debate is over privatizing ownership of public lands, because the West is so full of public lands.
It's crazy.
It's like over half public owned. Whether by the state or by federal, more than half of Idaho is national forest, I think. I may be wrong on that, but it's not far off. And, you know, so the question is, okay, well, if we privatize, what does that mean? Well, it means mining. It means logging. It doesn't really mean that property values are going to come down. It's easy to find a piece of property out in the middle of nowhere that's really cheap. So it's not like we're imagining cities or towns growing out in the middle of nowhere. It's more about resource extraction than anything else. And I think we had a pretty turbulent 20th century in terms of resource extraction. But I think at this point, like both in terms of values and also like policies that have been implemented, resource extraction is a lot better, at least domestically. Like a lot of these policies, what they do is they incentivize people to be really irresponsible in other countries and import all that stuff, which is like just does double the harm. It's just not in our own backyard. So, encouraging responsible resource extraction locally or domestically is probably a really good solution to that, because it means you're not paying transportation cost. You're also more familiar with the abuses that are happening because they're actually happening right in front of you.
Yes.
And there are people.
And you have to live with the consequences.
Yeah. There is actually a representative element to it. Whereas, you know, people in like the lithium mines in South America can't really complain to the House of Representatives.
Correct.
I think this is all really good. Tech enabled is very interesting. I assume that just means more science based management.
Well, I'm just thinking, is this like drones? Like, what are they doing to help rewild? Like, I'm imagining you've seen like usage of drones to like bring back certain, you know, threatened animal populations or something like that. I know there's been
stuff around extension to glacial lakes and stuff like that. Yeah,
sure. Yeah. I honestly,
yeah, I, I don't know much about it, but I do like national parks. So I do think there should be places that are still wild and rugged, and are protected from resource extraction as well. So yeah, I think, that's a very interesting point.
Yeah. So yeah, I think these are great, again, great steps overall. Again, it's encouraging to see Christians kind of taking, you know, going on the offensive with, you know, just in talking about a lot of these things. Like I don't remember the last time I heard Christians talk about, from number six here, algorithms, you know, the way that algorithms affect outside of our podcast. So again, to hear other people, to know that, you know, in the words of, God to what's his name, Elijah, not only us are left, you know, there's other people out there, like that's encouraging. So again, I meant that
building. It's very encouraging.
Yeah. So then here's the authors of this. Let me share this real quick. And then let's see here. Here we go. Boom. We got our authors. So Michael Toscano, the Institute of Family Service, Family Studies. Brad Littlejohn, who's a friend, Claire Morrell, who's a friend, met her at the National Conservatism Conference earlier this year. Emma is a friend. She's married to Buddy Jackson, who is a great dude. They both live in the D.C. area. And then a bunch of signatories who, if you're not familiar with Ryan Anderson, absolute gangster.
Yeah, that's great.
Yep, Robert George. I mean, there's a bunch of good folks here. So, yeah, go check out this article. We'll have both of these, both of the links included in the show notes below. And yeah, John, so that's we'll leave that for right now. And then again, this will be, we obviously got one more segment here to come, but now I think that's, you know, we'll leave it right there. And anything else you want to add to close out this part of the pod?
No. Those are both great articles. It's really encouraging to see more attention be given to the problems with social media and the digital world, and also like the digitization of everything else. You know, this is basically fiat creeping into everything. And as much as I like policy makes me nervous, a lot of these policies are oriented against technocratic fiat, which is just as much of a danger. And so, you know, having people who are working together and talking about removing the influences of that fiat from our lives and allowing us to live our lives in a, you know, free and responsible way. It's really nice to see. I feel like momentum is building. You know, I've been cautiously surprised pleasantly about the happenings in the Trump administration over the last couple of weeks. It seems like there's actually some substantial work being done. And you know, we'll see how it all pans out, because it's delicate and perverse incentives are always present. But I mean, to borrow a phrase, we're winning.
Amen. All right, John. I think we've arrived at the part of the podcast where we're gonna get into again, the Parsnips segment. For those of you who are not aware, Parsnips is the section of the podcast where we march methodically through all the different nips that exist in the Nosterverse. For those of you who aren't aware, a nip is a Noster improvement potentiality. Am I pronouncing that correctly?
Oh, I don't even know anymore. Noster improvement possibility. That's what
possibility, not potentiality. It's kind of same difference, but yeah. So basically, there's how many are there total, John? There's around, at least in number, about 100, but there's not actually that many.
Oh, that's a very controversial question, actually, Jordan. So, yeah, I mean, so the main repository of them is the GitHub repository, and there's something like 100. They're not sequentially ordered or anything like that, but there's lots of other standards that are out there. There's there's over 1,000 proposed NIPs.
Oh, wow.
In the repository alone. And then there's lots of other ones that are floating out there. And yeah, I mean, for anyone listening to this who's a developer and wants to get a NIP into the you know, public mind, the NIPs repo is the best way to do that right now. I think what we need most is a repository that is decentralized and has a good website, a good user interface, so that people can actually do all the things that we do mechanically on the NIPs repo. So if you're concerned about the NIPs repo being centralized currently, I'm not, because I have a high level of confidence in Fiat Jaff, but I know that not everyone is in this circle.
The problem with the existing system is all the trust that's required.
Exactly. So anyway, that's why it's controversial, but it's fine. We're doing fine. Lots of people use ones that are not enshrined into fiat law. So, but today I wanted to talk about NIP 89. I wrote a blog post recently and I was just reminded of this NIP. It doesn't get a lot of attention and it was introduced relatively late in the NIP's repo, but it's actually, like, in my opinion, it's not core to making Nostr work, but it is core to the possibilities that Nostr sort of opens up for technology, for open systems. So NIP 89, recommended application handlers. And what this basically is a way for an application to publish an event that says, hey, I'm an application. And that event, just like everything else, kind of gets, ends up on relays across the network. And when someone wants to find a client or a DVM or potentially a relay, I actually submitted a draft to this the other day, or a revision that adds a little bit to it and rewrites the language. So if someone's looking for a Nostr application or a Nostr infrastructure, they can just ask for these recommended handlers, which are kind 31990s from the network and kind of browse the list of clients out there. And what's neat about this is the handlers can specify what features of the Nostr protocol they support by saying what kinds they handle. So, you know, let's say with OLAS, now we're getting a bunch of kind 20s out in the network. And I'm in Coracle and I don't support kind 20s. Well, if I get a kind 20, I can just say, well, here's a link to OLAS or another application that supports kind 20s. And then you can just click straight through and view that content and potentially interact with it, remix, create your own content over in that application. And so what this does is it allows clients to immediately gain a whole bunch of possibilities through being able to refer their users to an application that can actually do something with that content. And another neat thing about it is we've got the 31989 event, which is a recommendation event. So the handlers just kind of stand on their own. And if you've got a bunch of handlers that all say, you know, I handle kind 20, it becomes very hard to pick which one you want to use because there's no authentication. You don't know who published these or whether the app is going to steal your private key or whatever it might be. And so it's not very actionable. But if you introduce Web of Trust, then you can ask all the people that you follow, or even, you know, people you follow, for recommendations for these application handlers. And that basically gives you a calculus to say, well, you know, like 300 people recommend this one, only 10 people recommend this other one. I'm going to go with the one that 300 people recommend, or I'm going to be more adventurous and try the other one. And so it builds in trust and your own, like, personal social graph into choosing these different applications. And you can see, like, different applications having different reputations in different social circles based on, you know, maybe like user experience or ease of use. So in a developer community, you might end up with different recommendations than in more of a end user sort of community. So that's basically what NIP 89 is. Coracle has support for this. And if you're listening to this and you're a developer, you should add support. Add a way for people to use a different application if your app doesn't support the kind that they're looking at. And if you're an end user, what you can do is you can go to nostrapp.link and you can find the apps that you use and you like and go ahead and rate and review those there. And those recommendations will actually show up on the network and they'll help other people who follow you to find clients that serve their goal. So this is just one of those ways of putting the user back at the center of the technology stack and leveraging those existing relationships that you have to navigate the digital world. So it's trust, but it's trust that originates with reality rather than network theory.
Yeah. And so how widely adopted is NIP 89?
It's It's more widely adopted in some ways than others. So there are lots, most apps have listings of NIP89, but not a lot of apps have integrations. So in Coracle, if you load up a note that is not one that we support, I think unless it's kind one, it'll show a little link out button at the bottom of the note card. Yep. And you can click on that and it'll show you a little list of apps that say that they support this kind. And then you'll see recommendations by people that you follow with a little like web of trust circle graphic to show you like, here's the one that you should probably use that's been most recommended. And it exists in other clients, but it hasn't been widely used, but I think it's actually, and like actual implementation of this is not the most important thing. What's important about it is it is the paradigm that surrounds it of putting the user at the center, encouraging clients to talk to each other and be interoperable, and also to consider other products in the space as assets to your own product, right? So like,
yeah,
like as Flotilla, I'm not competing with NIP29.com or Chachi. They're different approaches and they're complementary. And the fact that they talk to each other is great for everyone, for developers and for users. So,
awesome. Well, John, thank you for unpacking NIP89 for us. And this will not be our last parse nips. We're actually working on some merch as well, John. We don't have to go into detail, but we'll
might be
incredible. What I thought was an incredible merch idea. John disagreed. We'll see. If you'd like to hear more, please let us know on Noster, and we'll see if we get enough response. We'll let people know. John, I'll give you the last word for the pod today.
Yeah, no, that's it. I mean, I'm just glad to be thinking about these things. Privileged to be talking to you, Jordan. And look for the next book that we're going to be reading in a couple of weeks from now. It's going to be Super Bloom by Nicholas Carr, who also wrote The Shallows. We talked about that a year and a half ago, and that was excellent. So expecting the same.
I also, I told you, but for the audience, we also reached out to him to try to get him to come on the episode of the podcast. So he has not responded as far as I know, but I'm going to follow up with him and see if we can get that to happen. So yeah, we'll see. That'd be awesome.
All right, that's it. We will see you all on Noster.
See you on Noster.
Noster.